report shows Britain's arms sales to Saudi Arabia since the start of its war on Yemen was 3 times higher than previously announced. South Africa says it plans to deploy up to 25,000 soldiers to quell days of deadly unrest amid fears of food and fuel shortages. Also ahead, thousands rally in Greece and France against new COVID-19 restrictions. French police fire tear gas to disperse protesters in Paris. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Britain has reportedly exported around 3 times the amount of weaponry and military equipment to Saudi Arabia than it previously announced. A recent investigation by the Campaign Against Arms Trade shows British officials have used a loophole in the country's so-called transparent export controls. The report says the move intends to hide the real extent of the UK's contribution to the Saudi aggression against Yemen. While authorities claim British ministers signed off $6.7 billion worth of arms sales, the probe says the true figure is likely to be closer to $20 billion. Meanwhile, the UK's Department for International Trade, which approves all arms exports, has not disputed the findings of the study. Saudi Arabia launched the war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since then. Now, political commentator Michael Springman says Britain claims to be the cradle of democracy while in fact it is hiding its arms sales to states such as Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's bad publicity for the British and their terrible claim to being the mother of democracies and having the mother of all parliaments, when in fact what they're doing is hiding their sales to terrorist states like Saudi Arabia. The British get away with this by having something called an open export license for weapons. And you can sell weapons over 3 to 5 year period, but you needn't put the exact amount of the sale down. It can be blank. And this is how they get away with it in typical British perfidy. They say one thing and do another, and they believe that they are clean as the driven snow, when in fact they're dirty as a bunch of coal dust. So it's pure Britishness, and it makes money for Her Majesty's government.
The United Arab Emirates has inaugurated its embassy in Israel as part of a deal to normalize ties signed between the two sides, Monica Deal reports from the occupied West Bank.
Following Israel's inauguration of its embassy in the United Arab Emirates, the Arab Kingdom opened its embassy in Tel Aviv, situated in the Stock Exchange building. The Palestinians were outraged by the UAE's decision to establish ties with Israel, and now opening of its embassy in Tel Aviv means that the UAE has chosen to disavow the Palestinians' rights and collaborate with the occupying regime instead of boycotting it.
The UAE's move is part of the normalization deal between the two sides and comes at a time when Israel has escalated its atrocities against the Palestinians. We expect the world to boycott the Israeli regime and pressurize it into stopping its crimes against the Palestinian people.
The flag-raising ceremony was attended by the UAE Ambassador Mohammed Al-Khaja, as well as Israeli President Ishaq Herzog, who called the opening of the embassy an important milestone in Israel's journey towards the future, peace, prosperity, and security for the Middle East.
This move will help the Israeli regime to go further with its crimes against Palestinians. We hope that the latest war on Gaza could open the eyes of the Arab states on the true nature of Israel. Signing any agreement with Israel is in favor of the occupation regime's expansionist and aggressive ambitions.
Last month, Israeli Foreign Minister paid a landmark visit to the UAE and opened an embassy in Abu Dhabi and a consulate in Dubai. The UAE was the first of 4 Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel last year under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. By opening its embassy in Tel Aviv, Palestinians say the United Arab Emirates continues to reward the Israeli regime and giving up the Holy Lands. They call the UAE's latest normalization move treason. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the United Arab Emirates for opening its embassy in Israel, calling the move a stab in the back of the Palestinians.
The UAE move to open an embassy within the occupation of the state is an insistence on the national scene it committed by signing the normalization agreement. This behavior is certainly harmful to the Palestinian cause and serves the narrative of the occupation. It constitutes a stab in the back of our Palestinian people and the resistance that fought the Battle of Sword of Al-Quds.
The Hamas spokesman called on the UAE to cancel its normalization deal with the Israeli regime brokered by Washington last year. The opening of the embassy also drew condemnation from other Palestinian factions. The Islamic Jihad movement called the normalization with Israel a betrayal, a crime, and an ignorance of the truth. The movement said the UAE's move would be recorded in history as it comes at the height of Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. The West Bank-based Fatah movement also decried the opening of the UAE embassy in Israel and called for the expulsion of Abu Dhabi from the Arab League. In Lebanon, Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri has presented his cabinet lineup to President Michel Aoun. The move could end almost 9 months of political deadlock amid an economic crisis there. Hariri said he is now awaiting the president's response, which is expected on Thursday. He added that the proposed cabinet is composed of 24 specialist ministers in line with a French initiative. Hariri spoke after meeting with Aoun. Lebanon has plunged deeper into what the World Bank calls one of the world's worst economic crises in modern history. The financial dilemma, which has seen the value of the currency plummeting by more than 90%, has been deepened by the political deadlock. The country is without a formal government since the deadly Beirut explosion last August. Political analyst Elijah McNear says Western countries are responsible for the political and financial crises in Lebanon.
The EU, at the end of the day, is an instrument of the US in the Middle East. We see today the Western and European ambassadors talking in Iraq instead of the Americans, and we see the European ambassadors standing up to the Lebanese politicians in Lebanon and speaking on behalf of the Americans. So yes, they want to force the hand of the Lebanese politicians, and the EU think, along with the US, that sanction is working and is indeed working in the Middle East. The US is obtaining through sanctions what it failed to obtain through the war, and that is manifesting itself in Iraq, in Syria, and in Lebanon, and also a bit in Gaza. So we see the axis of the resistance is really having the upper hand facing the US hegemony, but on the other hand, is dearly suffering from the economic sanctions that is hitting all these members. That at the end of the game is to turn the society of Hezbollah and the other Lebanese societies who support Hezbollah or do not support Hezbollah against it and say, if Hezbollah give up on its weapons, then the situation will go back to normal.
Turning to other news now, Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have been engaged in talks over the past months to revive it in the wake of Washington's 2018 unilateral pullout, but the U.S. has failed to end anti-Tehran sanctions, the removal of which is a key demand by Iran to restore the accord.
It was July 14, 2015, that Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the US, France, Britain, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The agreement was later endorsed by the United Nations Security Council with Resolution 2231. Based on the accord signed during the administration of then-US President Barack Obama, Iran undertook to put limits on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of nuclear-related sanctions imposed on the country. Following the enforcement of the pact in January 2016, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed for 15 times in its reports, in a span over 3 years, that Tehran fully implemented its commitments under the deal. But in May 2018, Obama's successor, Donald Trump, unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which spotlighted Tehran's mistrust of Washington. 1 year after Washington's pullout of the JCPOA, Iran began to roll back its commitments as the remaining signatories failed to secure its interests under the deal. Nonetheless, the administration of Joe Biden expressed readiness to re-enter the JCPOA, which paved the way for Iran and the remaining signatories to hold several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital to revive the deal. Iran has stressed that the deal cannot be revived unless the U.S. removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. It has also insisted on a guarantee by the U.S. to not renege on the accord again in the future. Despite the Biden administration's willingness to restore the JCPOA, it has taken no concrete measures to that direction so far. Now, on the sixth signing anniversary of the landmark agreement, Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue its pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse its course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
South Africa plans to deploy up to 25,000 soldiers in two provinces where security forces are struggling to quell days of unrest. South Africa's Defense and Military Veterans Minister told the parliamentary committee that he has submitted a request for the deployment. Meanwhile, authorities announced that the security forces have arrested 1,754 people in connection with days of looting, arson, and violence. The unrest stokes fears of fuel and food shortages amid disruptions in several key industries. The crisis that engulfed South Africa after former President Jacob Zuma was jailed six days ago, has left more than 70 people dead. Coronavirus infections are on the rise in Europe and the United States, with the highly transmissible Delta variant contributing significantly to the recent surge. Spain has reported more than 43,000 new cases. The Spanish northeastern region of Catalonia, has a hotbed of the Delta variant, has now reintroduced restrictions and curfews in an attempt to contain the virus spread. The UK has reported 50 new coronavirus fatalities, the highest daily death tally since April. The number of new daily cases has also topped 30,000 for the seventh day in a row. The world's worst hit country, the United States, the rate of new cases has seen at least a 10% hike in 46 states. Some states have even seen a 50% jump in the number of infections in the past week. Clashes have erupted between French riot police and anti-vaccination protesters in the capital, Paris. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at President Emmanuel Macron's COVID-19 plan, which will be put in effect next month. The plan will require a vaccine certificate or negative test to grant access to public places, including restaurants and cinemas. A similar protest was held in the Greek capital, Athens. The Greek government announced Tuesday that the people will need to be vaccinated to be granted access to indoor public places. The country has also required all health workers to be inoculated against the virus. A protest against the renewal of an anti-migration deal between Italy and Libya has been held in front of the Parliament building in Rome. NGOs say the deal confirms Italy's complicity in torture of refugees.
On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African country so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies, basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The MKO traitors and terrorists had sided with Saddam against Iran during the U.S.-imposed war in 1980s, and their hands are dipped in the blood of more than 17,000 Iranians, including senior government officials, all killed on the orders of Washington. All terrorist outfits, including Daesh and MKO, are American and European mercenaries with a mission to undermine the stability of the Muslim world. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Iran Daily, Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, "The West Will Never Be Sincere with Iran and the Muslim World." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is not a strange, but a rather naivety on our part to think that the West, which currently dominates the international economy, will eventually become sincere towards the Muslim world, and towards the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular. No, this will never happen as long as we are divided in our own approach towards the West. The US and European Union included, whose prime goal is protection of the illegal Zionist entity and expansion of its political and economic influence in the Muslim world. First and foremost is the absence of political legitimacy for most ruling regimes, especially in the Arab states, an important factor that plays into the hands of the West, making it assume the role of protector to ruthless rulers, who in turn allow themselves to be used as pawns of divisions and funders of terrorist outfits to destabilize fellow Muslim countries. The most evident example in this regard is the case of Syria and Iraq, where the West let loose terrorists of all UN color, funded by the oil-rich regimes of the Persian Gulf, equipped with Western armaments, and serving as agents of Zionism, albeit disguised as puritanical Muslims, as the Salafis, Wahhabis, Daesh, all other anti-Islamic outfits do. Syria was a strong frontline state in the struggle for liberation of Palestine, while post-Ba'athist Iraq, which had shown the exit door to the American occupiers, had an elected government and all the ingredients for making it a vital component of the resistance front stretching from Iran to the Levant. The reason the West, its Arab clients, and the Israelis failed in their devilish designs was the Islamic Republic of Iran's firm support for these two countries and their heroic masses refusing to yield to the terrorists. Of course, the West, the Israeli regime, reactionary Arabs, succeeded in toppling the elected Muslim Brotherhood government of Egypt and also took control of Sudan through the same tactics of military coups, but failed miserably in other parts of the Muslim world, such as Yemen. The current influx of the Israelis into the UAE and Bahrain, with the tacit approval of Saudi Arabia regime, which has secret ties with the Zionist regime, is part of disparate bits to undermine the Palestinian struggle for independence and also to try to pose a threat to Iran, since the West views the dynamic Islamic Republic system as the greatest hurdle to its devilish designs in the region. In other words, the U.S. and European regimes will never reconcile to their realities in Iran and will resort to every satanic stratagem to undermine the Islamic Republic, as is evident by Washington's violation of the JCPOA and the refusal of Germany, France, and Britain to honor their commitment to it, despite Tehran's compliance with the clauses of the 2015 Geneva Accord. Those in doubt and still thinking of having normal relations one day with the US and Europe, with all the economic sanctions removed, should take a look at the current circus of the MKO terrorists in certain European capitals and the anti-Iran theatrics of the clowns it features, such as the notorious criminal Mike Pompeo, who is proud of lying, cheating, and stealing. The MKO traitors and terrorists had sided with Saddam against Iran during the U.S.-imposed war in 1980s, and their hands are dipped in the blood of more than 17,000 Iranians, including senior government officials, all killed on the orders of Washington. In short, all terrorist outfits, including Daesh and MKO, are American and European mercenaries with a mission to undermine the stability of the Muslim world.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. I am joined by my special guest and awesome sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam, my more dear sister and friend, Sister Zainab. I'm really, really, really happy. I'm actually looking forward to the meetings that we have.
You always find a new approach toward ordinary, everyday topics.
That's very kind of you.
During these last few episodes of Muslim Lady, we've been talking about tips and hacks in order to help young wives and husbands in their intimate relationships with one another, help them prepare for pregnancy and reproducing healthy, intelligent, spiritual, and sound-minded little Muslims to increase the nation of our beloved Prophet, inshallah ta'ala. And lately, we've been discussing the sensitive topic of impotency. The solutions, the really easy, off-the-counter, homemade remedy solutions that our brothers out there can refer to. So, Sister Razia, you told us about a few drinks and pastes and oils that they can apply.
Also, cleanliness, hygiene of
yes,
the body.
Yes, very important. This is something that people neglect because our Prophet was known for smelling good.
One-third of his income, he spent it on perfumes.
Exactly. Or people would know that he was in a place mm-hmm. from the smell the fragrance he'd leave behind.
Exactly. And also, I remember when Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha, was getting married, the noble prophet spent a considerable amount of money to buy perfume for Lady Fatima
Mashallah.
For her wedding, right?
Exactly.
So it's really important for men and women to keep into account points about hygiene, mm-hmm. personal self-care, and in addition to that, not only to be clean and to, you know, well, to smell burned, like soap, yeah, but also to smell like perfume.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And we talked about one very good Islamic way of getting rid of excessive hair, which was through depilatory powders, which include orpiment and lime. But these two chemicals in it purifies the body of poisons and of the toxicants that are inside the body.
Right.
Imam Ali alayhi salam says that if you get rid of your armpit hair, you will have less bad smell.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam cared about these little details of his Shias.
Exactly.
Like a father. Just like a father.
Just like a father.
It's
things
beautiful
that the Muslim nation in many Middle Eastern countries and non-Middle Eastern countries are neglecting, and you know, they just think that
It's material things.
Yeah.
Dunya.
We are very deeply involved with other more important spiritual aspects, whereas these are as important, right?
Exactly.
I said that in the previous program that according to the Noble Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, two things should a man do if he's a bachelor. First, fast a lot, and two, not get rid of his excessive body hair. Also, according to a hadith from Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, he says when you use this depilatory powders, it takes away grief, stress, and anxiety from
Mashallah.
You. Isn't that? So the next topic that we want to talk about that is also with regards to a men's reproductive system is certain points that we would like to mention, like causes of these problems and solutions to these problems, right? Which play an important effect in infertility of men.
Right.
So this topic that we're going to talk about specifically talks about infections or swelling in the male reproductive organ. Also, swellings or infection in the urinary tract infection. So we are not doctors here. We're not GPs here.
Yep.
Right? But for the general health of the male's reproductive system, certain very easy off-the-counter remedies are
suggested,
available,
right?
Suggested, that they can use. One of which is hollyhocks.
What's that?
It's a kind of flower herb.
Okay.
Right? They can make a kind of drink out of it and use it every day, which helps them with the urinary infection that they have, urinary tract infection.
Right.
So how they, what they
unless
do.
Unless, I mean, it's really severe,
yeah,
then you
no.
probably should go see a doctor.
Besides, yeah, of course, you have to refer to the doctor, but besides the medical medicine that you take, you can also use these traditional herbs.
And actually, one of the causes of impotency is anxiety and stress.
So one of the most important factors for a woman to reach the climax in a relationship, in an intimate relationship, is her psychological state.
Exactly.
If all the other factors are great, but she has stress or she's not happy with her spousal relationship and she's upset about something with regards to her husband or her life or her work or her studies or whatever, it will prevent her from reaching that stage.
Yeah. We're going to be back after a short message, so don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
We're back here in the studio, and I have Sister Razia Shamili with me, and we're discussing fundamental topics regarding happy marriage, pre-pregnancy preparations, and
impotency. If the man has a lot of stress from
a lot
work,
on his mind,
a lot
he's
of
preoccupied,
exactly.
something's eating him up at the inside,
he will have
yeah,
impotency.
Obviously. Well, and it's still ironic to me because on one hand, these intimate relationships with the spouse is a stress relief. And on the other hand, if you have too much stress, you can't have a healthy. So it's a balance, an equilibrium that we have to maintain in our lives.
Exactly. That is why the Noble Prophet divided his day into three portions, and he attended to three different needs of his soul and body.
Yep.
One for the worship of God, one for himself, and one for his family, if I'm not mistaken. Right? You know, in other words, the point is that going into extremes or becoming a workaholic or paying too much attention to the material aspect of your life, not having a balance in life will create some problems for you that you will get into a very miserable cycle.
Definitely.
Corrupted cycle that you get, you know, you have too much stress on your mind, then you can't have an intimate relationship with your wife, then you will start having arguments and conflicts, then you will not have any... Yeah, it will add to your stress, and this you will lose your...
Exactly, you'll lose everything.
Your marriage, your relationship. Right.
So I think it's important that from at a certain point, like especially for the gentlemen or even if the women are working, when you reach the threshold of your home, leave whatever happened behind you. Don't bring the office to the house.
Very good.
Just forget whatever happened. You can think about it tomorrow morning when you go back to the office. When you reach your house, when you open the door, and when you greet your family, you're a new person.
Exactly. This is mindfulness.
Yeah.
To live in the present moment, to live the now. Not to be concerned with the past, not to be over anxious about the future, but to take benefit of the now and present,
exactly.
Right?
And Imam Ali alayhi salam, he tells us so much about this. Mm-hmm. He's constantly emphasizing on the fact that you should let go of your past, holding on to it is just going to disrupt your future. Don't think about the future because you have to have tawakkul on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He'll provide for you. He'll take care of you. He was there before you were. Just stay with the now. This is all you have. The past is gone. The future might never come. Right? And right now is literally all that matters because it's literally all that exists. And we got to be more mindful of that.
Me too.
Constantly like thinking, oh, I shouldn't have said that, or like, what am I going to eat?
But you know, it's just a matter of practice of the mind.
Definitely.
Right? They say that just as our bodies have muscles, and if you want to be an athletic person, you have to
train it.
You train the muscles of your brain,
definitely,
of your mind, right? And I remember traveling to the UK a couple of years ago, and we went to a family, we visited a family, and at the entrance of their door, they all left their mobile phones, like 10 years ago.
Interesting.
Right. So this was a family rule done unconsciously by all of them, automatically by all of them, that you come attend to the social family gathering.
Mm.
It's family time now.
Right.
You leave behind everything else behind
the threshold of
your home, right? So just as we say that the home is a sanctuary, it's like a very holy place, so act like...
Yeah, we don't observe that. We bring all sorts of nonsense into the household.
Would you bring a non-mahram to your house?
Exactly, a total stranger, a hitchhiker, pick them up off the street and just...
So disturbing thoughts or feelings or... negative energy, they're hijackers, right?
Exactly.
Leave them behind the door.
Yep.
If you could just practice it. Anyways, one practical way of curing it, of course, if necessary, you know, you have to
see
your physician. But this also very helpful hint is to use the hollyhock, to use like two, three spoons of that herb, and then take one cup of boiling water and let it brew. Drink half of it in the morning and the other half at night.
Mm-hmm.
Also washing your private part also with this mixture is also very, very helpful. One very practical
solution
is washing your part with vinegar, used for men and women.
Natural vinegar, right?
Natural vinegar.
Right, like apple cider.
Right.
Right.
This is
Are we supposed to dilute it a little or just...
Yeah. For example, one half a cup with, like, in a very big pot.
Mm-hmm.
Basin. In a basin, and then you either sit in it or you wash yourself with it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Really interesting points. I hope you guys are taking note. Even if you're not facing this problem, and I hope you never do, it raises awareness. It's really important to raise awareness regarding these matters. And I feel that especially in the Islamic society, because of certain boundaries and the modesty that we adhere. So it's really important to talk about these things in a safe and healthy environment, address them, and present solutions for them. Until another episode of Muslim Lady, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover? Allah. Who is Ar-Rahman? Allah. Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the wake of assassination of Jovenel Moise, the unpopular, corrupt, and increasingly authoritarian U.S.-backed Haitian president, observers fluent in the history of foreign interference in the hemisphere's first truly free republic sounded the alarm over the same sort of calls for intervention in the name of stability that preceded so many previous American invasions of Haiti. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Haiti Assassination Raises Red Flags Among Observers Fluent in History of U.S. Intervention. Stay tuned for more. In the wake of assassination of Jovenel Moise, the unpopular, corrupt, and increasingly authoritarian U.S.-backed Haitian president, observers fluent in the history of foreign interference in the hemisphere's first truly free republic sounded the alarm over the same sort of calls for intervention in the name of stability that preceded so many previous American invasions of Haiti. Recently, the editors of the Miami Herald responded to Moore's murder by asserting that the U.S. must get off the sidelines and act. They wrote, "The U.S. as Haiti's biggest donor has no choice but to take the lead to stabilize Haiti. An international coalition could do immense good very quickly by picking five critical things to focus on, so that basic life in Haiti can continue. Good roads, reliable electricity, clean water, policing that works, and COVID vaccines." The Miami Herald editors were not alone. Robert Fatten, a professor of government affairs at the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, told France 24 that in previous decades, the UN, US, and France have sent troops to Haiti due to political insurgency. If things worsen, I assume we'd have an intervention, unquote. Echoing this sentiment, the editors of Washington Post called for a swift and muscular intervention in Haiti. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said recently at a press conference that the Biden administration is prepared to respond to requests for assistance from Haiti's interim leadership and that the U.S. expects to be in receipt of formal requests for armaments. When asked specifically about the history of U.S. intervention in Haiti and any appetite to intervene again, Price indirectly answered that the United States has an will continue to stand by to provide assistance to the Haitian people. Jake Johnson, a research associate for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, told Maria Abi Habib of New York Times that there will be a lot of calls for international intervention and sending troops in the name of restoring stability to Haiti. But it's important that we take a step back and see how international intervention has contributed to this situation, Johnson said. There's already been billions of dollars spent on so-called nation building in Haiti, which has only contributed to the erosion of the state and politicization of these institutions. To now say we need to do more of this, well, that won't work. Amid reports that at least one U.S. citizen was among those arrested in connection with Moise's assassination and the mounting calls for foreign intervention, the U.S.-based anti-war group Black Alliance for Peace, BAP, said that it smells a rat.
What happens now is the question, BAP said in a statement, adding, will the Biden administration and other political players use this moment as a pretext for military intervention, as was done in 1915? Whatever happens, the Black Alliance for Peace remains steadfast in our call against foreign intervention and occupation of Haiti, the group said. And we call on all anti-imperialist and Black internationalist forces to stand with the Haitian people and oppose U.S. and European interventions deployed under the guise of the responsibility to protect. For over a century, the U.S. military has helped corporations plunder Haiti, carrying out invasions, supporting coups, and menacing anyone who fights for the freedom and independence of the country, writes artist and activist Rachel Damond. Even if they use humanitarian language, the goal of any U.S. intervention remains the same. Haiti, site of the world's only successful nationwide slave revolt, was the first country in the hemisphere to win its independence after the United States. Over the course of 13 years, beginning in 1791, Haiti's slaves fought to end not only slavery, becoming the first nation to permanently to do so, but also French rule in a colony that, while only the size of Maryland, produced a much wealth as all 13 colonies of the future United States combined. Haiti was the first truly free nation in the Americas and the world's first Black republic. Its revolution also belied the hypocritically egalitarian pretensions of the French and U.S. revolutions, the latter which fought to preserve and expand slavery while declaring that all men are created equal. Haiti's revolution, led by Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Toussaint Louverture, Henry Christopher and others, was a tremendous inspiration to enslave Black people yearning to be free throughout the hemisphere. It also proved a major catalyst for early U.S. expansion, as it led Napoleon Bonaparte to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States. Thus began the more than 200-year history of U.S. intervention in Haiti. Instead of exalting Haiti's hard-won freedom, the United States refused to recognize the country until 1862. What it did recognize was the crushing debt imposed by France as a condition for peace that continues to harm Haitians to this day. In 1891, U.S. President Benjamin Harrison attempted to acquire a naval base at Mont Saint-Nicolas, prompting Frederick Douglass, the U.S. Minister and Consul General at the time, to declare that there is perhaps no one point upon which the people of Haiti are more sensitive, superstitious, or united than upon any question touching the cession of any part of their territory to any foreign power. Haiti maintained its sovereignty for 116 years until President Woodrow Wilson, who claimed to champion national self-determination, ordered a U.S. invasion in the name of stability following the assassination of Haitian President Jean Wilburn Guillaume Sam. The murder sparked widespread violence, and U.S. Marines throughout time landed at Port-au-Prince and began forcibly soothing everybody. The U.S. would occupy Haiti until 1934, killing thousands of Haitians who resisted the invaders. Occupation forces and administrators implemented forced labor in service of building the kinds of infrastructure advocated by the Miami Herald editors, Jim Crow segregation, and looting of the country's finances for the benefit of New York banks. Rape of Haitian women and children by U.S. troops ran rampant and unpunished. Following the withdrawal of U.S. troops, successive administrations in Washington, D.C. supported Haitian dictators, including the brutal kleptocrat François Papadoc, D'Oliveira not only turning a blind eye to his regime's gross human rights violations, but also training its security forces. Meanwhile, U.S. economic interests profited handsomely from their investments in a stable Haiti, as they claim. Papadoc was succeeded upon his death in 1971 by his son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc D'Oliveira, who was also backed by the U.S. regime, even as his death squads murdered as many as 60,000 Haitians. Haiti finally held democratic elections in 1990. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a Catholic priest, was elected with two-thirds of the vote. However, less than a year later, he was overthrown in a military coup, whose plotters included CIA operatives. In 1994, Joe Biden, then junior U.S. senator from Delaware, opined that if Haiti just quietly sunk into the Caribbean or rose up 600 feet, it wouldn't matter a whole lot to our interest. President Bill Clinton did not agree, and that year his administration secured United Nations Security Council authorization to stage a U.S.-led invasion to restore democracy to Haiti. Clinton sent 25,000 troops on a nation-building mission, and Aristide was returned to the presidency. However, a decade later, the George W. Bush administration actively worked to topple Aristide's government in events culminating in a 2004 coup in which the same CIA-trained forces that previously ousted the president again played a key role. The nation-building exercises that the United States and its international partners have embarked upon in Haiti and around the world have done little to create functioning states, instead creating a system where questionable actors with little national support like Misumois are propped up. The easiest way to achieve short-term stability, writes the Times' Abi Habib. Daniel Larrison, contributing editor at antiwar.com, argues on his website that the U.S. regime needs to break the habit of assuming that political instability somewhere requires military intervention, whether by the U.S. or others. Writer Joseph Sturgeon III adds that Haiti has been struggling against imperialism from the West since the very day she established her sovereignty. It is time that Haiti establish her own destiny, free from intervention from the U.S. regime, from France, from Britain, or any colonial power. She did not carry out a revolution to be under Western control. She carried out her revolution to be free.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.